This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us today. On the program this afternoon, we're going to talk about the importance of crop diversity for the security of the world's food supply. We'll talk about where our food comes from, which is also the title of a book by ethnobiologist Gary Paul Nabhan. The book's subtitle is Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Vavilov was a Russian scientist who traveled five continents collecting seeds. Not only did he collect seeds, he also talked to the people, the farmers who grew those seeds, and he took careful note of landscape and climate. In this portion of the program, we'll talk about Vavilov, what he learned and why it's important that we think about him and his efforts today. Gary Paul Nabhan, who has retraced Vavilov's steps in many countries, including Afghanistan, Colombia, Ethiopia, Italy, Kazakhstan, Mexico, and the U.S. He is our guest. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Gary Paul Nabhan is an ethnobiologist, conservationist, farmer, and essayist. His honors include a MacArthur Fellowship and the John Burroughs Medal for Nature Writing. The author of many books and articles, he's currently a research social scientist at the Southwest Center at the University of Arizona. You'll find him online at www.garynabhan.com. And the name is spelled N-A-B-H-A-N. Where Our Food Comes From is published by Island Press. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Gary Nabhan, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
I'm so happy to be with you and be talking to the people in your part of the country.
Here we are in the heart of Illinois.
Well, also the place where much of Vavilov's own legacy was played out in the U.S. through Jack Harlan and Jan DeWitt, two of the great University of Illinois scientists.
Oh, well, maybe you should tell us a little bit more about that then.
Well, Jack Harlan was a young man when Vavilov visited his father, another great crop scientist, a grain breeder. And so the Harlans had probably the longest relationship with this famous Russian plant explorer. And as he was being threatened by Stalin, they developed a code language that Harry Harlan, Jack's father, and Vavilov wrote back and forth between mails to let the Western world know whether Vavilov and his seed bank were safe or not. So it was a very poignant story, and Jack Harlan was inspired by Vavilov to go on and reassess the status of these great centers of crop diversity around the world that I've recently had the blessing to visit.
Mm. You open the book with the moving story of a seed bank and the people who worked there at the time of Stalin, the city Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, the year 1941, the beginning of the Nazi blockade. Tell us about the bank's holdings and the remarkable people who attended them.
Well, if justice would be done, Vavilov and his colleagues would be as well known as Darwin or Thomas Edison. They created the first world collection of cultivated plants. Vavilov himself brought back 220,000 kinds of seeds and tubers from 64 countries, and his staff then specialized in each of these crops to adapt it and evaluate it in different climatic zones and share their information and the seeds with other scientists. But although Lenin had fully supported Vavilov and his institute, Stalin needed a scapegoat for blaming the failure of collectivization on and the resulting famine in Russia. And so support was cut off from the CBEC during the siege of St. Petersburg when Finnish and Nazi troops were coming in to take St. Petersburg over, and literally the staff of the Vavilov Institute locked themselves in the building, took shifts guarding the seats both against enemy troops and against the hungry of their own city, and several of them starved to death protecting these seats.
Were the holdings of the seed bank kept out of the hands of the Nazis?
Some of them were intercepted, and ironically, it was by a Nazi special command called the Sammelkommando that had very competent scientists were part of it, and they realized the value of these seeds and sequestered them in a castle in Austria, and after the war made them available widely, not just to Germany or to Russia, but made them available to the world's crop conservation and breeding community once more. So many of the seeds were lost due to the poor conditions under which they were stored or grown, and those poor conditions continued after World War II. So we did lose some of Vavilov seeds, but others have been widely shared and were, in fact, shared before World War II.
Yeah. Plants are living things. You can't just take seeds and put them in a vault. How are seeds, roots, nuts, and fruits preserved? How is this heritage kept?
Well, obviously, the primary way that they're kept on our planet is by the careful cultivation year after year by farmers and orchard keepers and gardeners. And seed banks have become a backup that we use in the times of catastrophe to consolidate a sample of the great diversity of seeds on Earth, certainly nothing like the total diversity, and to make sure that there is some kept in safekeeping, free of political influences, hopefully, that will be available for future cultivation and even for plant breeding. But the key thing is that Vavilov understood that his system was but a backup to what goes on into fields. And so we hear about the great seed vault being developed in the Arctic Circle, and he would have taken interest in that, but knew that it's more important for these to be in the hands of farmers.
Iraq's seed bank was also threatened by war, the war that began in 2003. How has it fared?
Well, it was ironically at Abu Ghraib, and the same place that the atrocities have happened that we've heard about in The New Yorker and on NPR, of course. Some scientists in Iraq knew that they had priceless seeds and knew that those seeds needed a backup if there were to be conflict between the U.S. and Iraq. And many of those were taken out clandestinely and taken to Syria before the U.S. attack on Iraq. That seed bank was basically vandalized and damaged the same way the great Museum of Art and Antiquities was. And so there's not much left at Abu Ghraib.
This raises the question, just how secure are the world's seed banks?
Well, there's two answers to that. There's a great effort being made by my friend Kerry Fowler to organize a global Seed Diversity Trust out of Rome that is not only collaborating with the vault at Svalbard in the Arctic Circle, but trying to give financial support to the most important seed collections around the world, whether they're in a developed or a developing country. more importantly, from my point of view, and I think Vavilov would see this as well, is that farmers need the incentives to have this diversity out in their fields because they're the best way that we can buffer our food system from the vagaries of climate, war, and other kinds of change. So having a diversity of crops and fields and having them planted in different geographic areas is incredibly important to maintaining this overall diversity that's essential to our food security.
Mm. And do they have the incentive or incentives to maintain this diversity?
I went into this book being a bit of a pessimist, having heard for years that there was wholesale replacement of traditional varieties by high-yielding hybrid varieties happening, what is commonly known as the Green Revolution era of crop improvement, where perhaps higher-yielding or nutritionally superior varieties, but far fewer, were promoted in a way that farmers gave up the many, many varieties they themselves had developed. I was surprised to see that those high-yielding varieties had not taken root in all these landscapes that we call the centers of diversity, that people would try them out but evaluate them with the same keenness and intelligence that they would their own varieties or those of their neighbors. And so in a place like, say, Siwa Oasis in the middle of the Sahara on the Egypt-Libya border, I was expecting a wholesale loss of the traditional Berber and Bedouin varieties because that area had become part of the globalized economy within the last 20 years and linked by pavement or bitumen roads to the entire network of the Mediterranean. I was surprised to see that people still value those traditional varieties, particularly of dates and olives and salt-tolerant vegetables, even more than they value the fanciest or the highest-yielding variety from the outside. So farmers are intelligent. They don't say no to new varieties, but they oftentimes keep the things that mean most to their culture and are best adapted to their environment.
Hmm. Can you give us an example of how a traditional crop or a crop that's not the, you know, the latest and the fanciest, the greatest yield, what a crop, what a plant could mean to a particular culture?
Sure. Perhaps I can first give an example from where I live here in the deserts of Arizona, and then one from where my ancestors are still, I mean, the descendants of my ancestors are still living in Lebanon. Here in the deserts of Arizona, numerous indigenous communities, Native American tribes, if you will, have maintained a great variety of crops, the greatest north of the Tropic of Cancer in North America, that are really well adapted to the sand dunes, dry farming environments of what we call the Four Corner States, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado. So the Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, and other communities there are not only deserve to have farmers' rights for the unique crops that they've developed, but they're incredibly good at growing crops in just 8 inches of rainfall. So they have carefully selected the seeds for their particular environment, but they also use them in ceremonies. When a couple is to be married, one family has to provide literally hundreds of pounds of food to the other family in preparation of the wedding ceremony. And so it's specific things, blue corn, red corn, yellow corn, white corn, an equivalent set of beans, an equivalent set of squashes. And these are part of the ceremonial life and the cultural rituals of people, as well as being integral to their nutritional well-being. Now, where I came from in Lebanon, where my father and grandfather came from in the Fertile Crescent area, it's certain kinds of wheat that are used for bulgur wheat. Not every variety is suited to the particular traditional foods that are eaten in Lebanon and Syria. So some varieties, like a wheat called Horani, has persisted despite 40 years of introductions of other hybrid wheats, perhaps better yielding wheats, not only because it's well adapted there, but because of the particular ethnic foods eaten in a region that one cannot simply replace another and have the same culinary qualities.
Hmm. And back to this part of the world, there is a chapter in the book, or there's some information in the book where you talk about, and this goes back to being hopeful, about, and I hope I'm going to pronounce this particular classification or this group of grasses, teosinte.
Teosinte. That means the mother of corn in some, second languages. It is a wild relative of corn, perhaps the ancestor, or certain varieties or populations of it are the ancestor down in the Rio Balsas area west of Mexico City. But farmers for centuries have brought their corn into fields where this teosinte grows so that they could hybridize and so that their corn could be rejuvenated or revitalized genetically. And they have a metaphorical language of talking about this. Of course, they're not talking about it in terms of genes or alleles or DNA. But they know that through certain episodes of hybridization, their corn seems to be more vigorous in subsequent plantings. And now teosinte is threatened in many parts of Mexico due to burgeoning cities, fragmenting the habitats where it remains.
Hmm. I looked for it on the internet and I found a beautiful photograph of a teosinte. It looks to me like a very small ear of corn. It has a tassel. It had, the picture I saw had kernels. Beautiful, beautiful plant.
It is. It's sort of like a sleek but slender version of maize. The seeds are shaped differently and are much smaller and come together on a rachis or stalk differently than those do on a corn cob. But you can see the resemblance. It was something that Vavilov cherished when he finally came across teosinte in central Mexico. There's a wonderful picture of him hugging a teosinte.
Yeah.
And he had the insights to sort of understand what crops were domesticated or which were wild ancestors of our major crops, even before there was good scientific documentation of that entire process. So he was a man with incredible insight and vision in the field.
Yeah. You say his legacy is much more than the seeds he collected, and the good news here, too, is that the seed bank on St. Isaac Square in St. Petersburg now bears his name. But anyway, his legacy, you say, is more than the seeds he collected. Talk with us about his legacy.
Well, one of the remarkable opportunities that I had was to gather his field photos and journal notes and maps from colleagues in St. Petersburg, Russia, and then with colleagues that are knowledgeable about each of the regions that Vavilov visited. I certainly didn't do this work alone. I got to visit the very same roads and routes and fields and marketplaces that he did. And his details in his journals were such that I could see how the crops had changed in elevation or in diversity through time. He would literally make entire inventories of every crop that he saw in particular places and note the elevation. In some cases, like Central Asia, because of global warming, because of changes in land use, some of these crops are now being grown 1,500 feet higher than where they were grown at the time that Vavilov first visited them in 1916. And so we can use his information as a benchmark by which to see how the patterns of diversity in the world have changed through time.
Now, in his work, he noticed that some plants were in trouble, and he was concerned. What had he seen? Why was he concerned? How concerned was he?
Well, it was remarkable that he and Harry Harlan, Jack Harlan's father, had correspondence not using the word genetic erosion or the term biodiversity loss as we do today, but they had visited some places over a period of 15 to 20 years and noticed that there was major shifts in what people planted. And they were beginning to realize that some widely promoted crop varieties were replacing what they called land races or traditional varieties that peasant farmers had developed and kept for centuries. And this concerned them. They realized that we couldn't take these resources for granted. And perhaps he and Harry Harlan were among the first handful of people in the entire world to notice this potential loss of biodiversity and what it might mean for food security.
What did he think the answer was?
He certainly was enough of a scientist and collector to know that having a backup collection wouldn't hurt, because if something was lost, these seeds could be re-released to the same people. But he was groping to document the importance of this diversity in the field. He had an intrinsic sort of intuitive understanding of it. And he often offered seeds to people he was visiting, seeds from another climate, a comparable climate of where they live, so that they could benefit from diversity too. So I think he sensed that agriculture would never be static, that we couldn't freeze it in time. But by incorporating seeds from comparable areas and having some dynamism that protected diversity rather than narrowed it, people would be better off.
What might he have made, do you think, of our reliance on biotechnology?
Vavilov was clearly a logical positivist that thought science could do wonders. And he predicted that in the future, people would be able to move genes around to accomplish certain goals, and that evolutionary science would have a kind of technical success that would allow the unimaginable to happen, that we could move genes between different species, perhaps. However, he was totally focused on a particular goal, which was dealing with reducing the frequency of famine. He wanted nutritious, hardy crops. And so some of the ways that biotechnology has been used, I don't think he would say is using those techniques for their highest purpose. That his ultimate goal was not making money for certain corporations or combining crops with certain pesticides, but really reducing the frequency of famine and crop failure. And so hardiness and some disease and pest resistance were his agenda, and deeply evaluating then whether the crops were adapted to particular landscapes and cultures. I think he would have built additional steps in to the evaluation of any hybrid or genetically modified organism before it was released. And that was what perhaps we've neglected that he had insights to.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Gary Paul Nabhan. He is an ethnobiologist, a conservationist, farmer, and essayist. He's the author of Where Our Food Comes From, among many other books. The subtitle of Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Vavilov was a Russian scientist, a botanist, and geneticist. He was born in 1887. He died in 1943. This afternoon here on the program, we're talking about the importance of crop diversity for the security of the world's food supply. And where Vavilov comes in is that he collected seeds. He traveled five continents collecting seeds. If I'm recalling correctly, 220,000 specimens himself. But not only did he collect seeds, he also talked to the farmers who grew those seeds, and he took careful note of growing conditions, the landscape, and the climate. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, if you've got a question or a comment for Gary Paul Nabhan, give us a call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. This year, in 2008, we saw the price of food, notably wheat and rice, shoot up. We saw food riots, among other places, in Haiti and Bangladesh and in Africa. Among the reasons given, rising demand, the cost of fuel, weather. What are your thoughts about what we've seen this year in terms of the rising price of food and the reaction to this in some parts of the world?
Well, Celeste, that's the key of why I really wrote this book. It's a cautionary tale about what we're going through now. I have a sense that we've not only reached the peak in our use of fossil fuel, but in that of fossil groundwater too, so that agriculture will never pump as much fuel from the ground or water from the ground as it has over the last century. And that means that because we're so addicted to these two inputs, petrochemicals that are used both to fuel our tractors and to produce fertilizers, and the water that we use to combine with that fertilizer to get higher growth rates out of our plants, if we don't come up with some other strategy than using these inputs, our food prices will continue to go up and our yields down. I believe that Vavilov had some key insights here, that looking at the match between crops and particular landscapes was critical, that if we have a crop finally adapted to a particular soil and growing season, that it can out-yield with lower inputs the pampered crops that aren't adapted there, that we have to put under row covers, usually fossil fuel-expensive plastics, to grow in the same environment. What I'm getting at is that he was keenly interested in the biological wisdom of what we now call biological diversity, how plants have a way of dealing with particular environments, and the cultural wisdom that we now call traditional knowledge of peasant and indigenous farmers, and that he understood that those two work together to have a more harmonious agriculture that's not at war with the environment. And I think that a large proportion, perhaps not all of our agricultural systems, have to return to that biological wisdom inherent in diverse crops and the cultural wisdom inherent in diverse farming cultures.
Hmm. Gary Paul Nabhan, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Again, listeners, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Nabhan, I just want to thank you for being on the show today and also for your book, Coming Home to Eat, which I think came out in 2002. I really think that in a way, you know, before Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma came out a year or two ago, you really were the guy who sort of brought local foods to the forefront of the minds of a lot of people that I know, both here in town and across the country. So I think that book is really important and influential, and that people should read it. And also, I think it's interesting that you're on the show today. Last night I was at a dinner here in town where Fred Kirschenman from the Leopold Center in Iowa was speaking, and he was touching on many of the same issues that you were just speaking of just now. And also Michael Pollan's 8,000-word essay in yesterday's New York Times Magazine, where he pretty much lays out a plan, a proposed plan of action for the president-elect, whoever it is, regarding our food supply, not just in the United States, but also addressing the food supply issues in the world, everything from climate change, peak resources, to policy and dealing with foreign countries and their own food supplies as well. And so I think it's interesting that, we've hit this trifecta of talking about it just in the last 2 days here locally. My question for you is, what can towns, you know, like Urbana is a college town with about 40,000 people, what can towns and also within those towns, neighborhoods do to work together? I know in my neighborhood we've talked a lot about having seed swapping parties in January, you know, so we can diversify our gardens a little bit. But what else can we do? I think food security really does start in your own neighborhood, and usually municipalities and cities catch on long after people in neighborhoods have been at work. Do you have any comments?
Well, I'm fascinated by all your comments and questions. I was with Michael Pollan and Fred Kirschenman at this wonderful Slow Food Nation event in San Francisco about 5 weeks ago, where with my dear friend Dan Imhoff, they released this food declaration that much of Michael's manifesto yesterday was based on. And I think Michael is wise enough and one of the best communicators on this that we've ever had, and is hitting the nail on the head, and that it takes local action of the kind that you were implying, that the further development of community-supported agricultural projects to bring people who don't have enough growing space in their own backyard, local seasonal foods is certainly one thing. We've had a community-supported wild foraging project that also brings in wild apples, berries, ramps, wild greens, and other foods that gives a complement to our domesticated crop base. It also means making food more accessible to the poor by making sure that bus routes where the poor live in each community make them accessible to community gardens, the grocery stores with the lowest prices for the most nutritious foods, and that kind of thing. So I think it means thinking about our food sheds, our local food sheds, and how we can be most efficient in accessing food and making sure that those foods are not available only to the elite, but the poorest of the poor and the marginalized as well. So good luck with what you're doing.
Thank you so much for mentioning lower income folks as well. I think that's a piece of the puzzle that has been missing, and I know that locally we are definitely making efforts to get something going. So thank you very much.
Well, I'm honored to have a chance to talk with you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited for Gary Paul Nabhan. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. And the listener was referring to the New York Times Magazine, yesterday's magazine, October 12th, 2008, and it is devoted to food. And along with Michael Pollan's thought-provoking essay, there's also some portraits of some folks that they've dubbed food fighters, which is really interesting reading as well. And this gets to the listener's comments about people like, you know, you and me, and what we can do, how we can think more intelligently about what we eat, the way we eat, and drink. Let's take another call now. I'll call just in now on line one, a cell phone. Good afternoon. Line one? I don't think. Maybe we'll see what's going on there and see if we can figure out what we've got happening. So anyway, what you want to take a little bit, go a little bit further out here in terms of follow-up, Gary Paul Nabhan, in terms of what role we can play as consumers, as citizens in this endeavor.
One other book that I've been working on the last few years, it was released in the spring, is called Renewing America's Food Traditions. And I think it's important to remember that these foods aren't just genes or calories, that they're organisms that enrich our lives in many other ways. The stories and the history and the recipes that are fitted to each of them. And in this Renewing America's Food Traditions book, we remind people that there are about 1,500 foods that are now threatened or endangered in North America, plant and animal, immigrant and native, terrestrial and marine, from fish to fowl to livestock breeds to heirloom vegetables, and that each region of the country has a set of these things that has now been neglected for virtually over a century, and we're close to seeing these foods fall off our tables. And so one thing that this Renewing America's Food Traditions Initiative, it's a project based at Slow Food USA that links up seven of the most effective nonprofits in the country. One thing it does is encourage people to be local food sleuths, to find the things that were formerly in their food system and bring them back into cultivation, get their seeds from the university, try them out, have tastings of them, record their stories and historic recipes. And we're promoting a new national holiday called American Traditions Picnics that we hope the new president will take up, because we have no holiday in the United States that honors the people who bring us our food. We honor politicians and soldiers, but not our own farmers and orchard keepers and fishermen. So we're very intent on saying that these people should be our heroes as well.
Mm. Let's take another call now. Listener on line two, a cell phone caller, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm cell phone's cutting in and out. I was very interested in your guest's idea about our natives coming in together and crossbred teosinte with whatever corn that they had. I was wondering if he'd talk about that just a little bit more. I'll just hang up and listen. I think it's a great idea to be honoring our farmers you know, our ancestors in that regard and their good works. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, thank you. What I was specifically referring to is a remarkable community in the Sierra Madre, the mountains just south of New Mexico. In the Sierra Madre, there is a group of Tepehuan Indian farmers that I visited over the years, probably twice over the last 15 years, and some people who've lectured many times in Champaign-Urbana, a scientist named Garrison Wilkes, and his colleagues have also studied it there. And this is where this wild relative of corn is inhabiting a few fields, but not all of them. And people from as far as 40 miles away, bring their corn over to have it reinvigorated through what we call hybrid vigor. And I've studied this process with a fine scientist based in the Midwest, John Dobley, who was one of the people who also did the, I think, most convincing studies that show that certain kinds of teosinte were the direct ancestor of corn.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just thought that on a program of this sort, people who are listening this far into it, at least, should know about Seed Savers Exchange in Decorah, Iowa. This is an organization that does just what the guest is talking about. They gather seeds and they maintain a big seed bank, and they have members who submit seeds and also who can get seeds from the seed bank, so that the operation of seeing to it that the seeds are not just in the seed bank, but that are being actively grown in fields around the country is taken care of. And a person who's interested in this, if they just Google Seed Savers Exchange, I'm sure it'll come right up.
Well, thank you. I didn't want to toot the horn of some of my best friends, but I've been on the Seed Savers Exchange board for most of my adult life. I was just this last weekend with its co-founder, Kent Whaley, and we were doing an heirloom apple workshop together in northern Michigan. And the caller is exactly right that groups like Seed Savers Exchange and the Southern Seed Legacy in Athens, Georgia, and Native Seed Search that I helped co-found a quarter century ago are really helping this become an effort that is not just restricted to scientists alone, but a grassroots effort that is very participatory and very fun. And I have to emphasize, it sounds like a lot of darkness when we talk about the fate of the world's food supply and famine, but there's incredible pleasure and fun and, what should I say, gastronomic delights that can be manifest through participating in something like this. These foods are often delicious. There's wonderful stories with them, and wonderful people are attracted to seed saving. So,
right. Now, while I have you, your attention, there's a couple of questions that occurred to me during the course of the program. Are there estimates of the proportion of the seeds in the Russian seed bank that you were telling us about that, in fact, made it through the war, and also the proportion in the Iraq seed bank that made it through that war?
There is not a good estimate of how many seeds made it through World War II, because some of the seeds had been distributed beforehand, and frankly, the Russians have been a bit embarrassed to admit how many of the seeds were lost in the post-World War II era when T.D. Lysenko, the archenemy of Avalov, took over the Russian scientific hierarchy. And so we don't have a good estimate of that. Many of them have been recollected since then by Russians and other scientists. With regard to the Iraqi seed bank, my understanding is that it was just a couple dozen high-value seeds that were delivered to Syria clandestinely, and that most of it was lost.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We have to wrap up here, but I want to come back in a real concrete fashion to talk about the value of crop diversity, and that is maybe specifically you could give us some information here about how crop diversity could help us in the threat of something like climate change.
Well, the remarkable thing is that farmers themselves are coming up with some strategies in advance of what scientists are implementing. In Central Asia, in the country of Tajikistan, the Pamiri or Badakhshani farmers began to realize that some of their fruit trees were not getting enough cold days during the winter anymore to stimulate flowering and fruiting. And what they've done is something that farmers in nearly any other part of the world could also do, and that's to plant what are called common gardens of varieties from both higher and lower elevations, a diversity of varieties, to see which ones are likely to produce over the next 20 to 50 years, because the ones that we've planted in the past may not be able to have all their needs met with the current climate. So one way is to get diversity out in the field again and evaluate it for the current and projected future climates. And this means farmer researcher collaborations, which I think is the key to all of our agricultural research. It's not that our agricultural scientists are too esoteric or our layman farmers are too simplistic. The best work will come out of their collaborations. Mm.
Gary Nabhan, there we have to leave it. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, and I'm really grateful.
Gary Nabhan is an ethnobiologist, a conservationist, farmer, and essayist. His books include Why Some Like It Hot and Coming Home to Eat. We talked with him this afternoon about this book, Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolai Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. The book is published by the Island Press. And by the way, you'll find our guest online at www.garynabhan.com. And his name is spelled Nabhan.